KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Charlotte Cote, Associate Professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Washington. Her research examines issues around Native governance, politics, law, and sovereignty in the United States and Canada. She is chair of a project to build a longhouse-style facility on the University of Washington campus and also serves as a member of the Potlatch Fund Foundation board. Charlotte Cote is here today to discuss her book, Spirits of Our Whaling Ancestors, Revitalizing Macaw and New Chalnulf Traditions, published in 2010 by the University of Washington Press. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What led you to write your book, Spirits of Our Whaling Ancestors?
It was really important to me to write, especially my first book, write something that was significant to who I was as a New Chalnulf person. I was born and raised in my native community and always understood the importance of whaling and of that tradition. And so when I went back to school and when I was going to grad school, I started thinking about what I would write my dissertation on. And that was roughly around the time that the macaw were getting ready to start whaling. And that really excited me about my research, the research that I could do with my people and also the macaw in writing a history that was significant to who we were and writing it from a perspective of someone who was born and raised in that tradition and really wanting to tell a story that the people from within that culture was telling. And that's really how I ended up coming to write this book.
What sources did you use in writing the book?
Well, the sources I use, again, growing up in my native community, I was immersed in the culture and the traditions of the New Chalnulf, specifically the Tsishat, which is the community, the one community of the 14 communities that make up the New Chalnulf Nation. So a lot of the sources were just the people around me, my elders, the leaders of our nation, our family members, these wonderful stories that I was raised with, and as well some very important written material that was left to us from field work that was done in my community, in the Tsishat community, in the early 1900s. And this was field work done by Edward Sapir, who was an anthropologist linguist, who left very rich and detailed ethnographic accounts, which he received from the words of my ancestors, in particular, my great-great-grandfather, Siachapus, who I write about in this book, who came from a whaling tradition, who was raised to be a whaler, raised to be a hunter, a marine mammal hunter. So it was a weaving of those kinds of oral and written texts that came together to make this book.
What has been the significance of whaling for the Macaw and New Chalnulf people historically?
Well, historically, whaling had economic, political, social, and spiritual significance. And there are archaeological discoveries in our territories, and the Macaw and New Chalnulf are in the Pacific Northwest. If people don't know where we actually are, our territories are on the west coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia and also the most western coast of Washington State in the Cape Flattery area, and the Macaw people live there. We say that the border crossed us, and we have in our oral histories, in our stories, this great flood that eventually led us to be on the Vancouver Island and the Macaw to be here in Washington State. The archaeological discoveries provide material evidence that whaling had been central to our groups, to our cultures, for over 2,000 years. That is, they found implements showing that we had whaled over 2,000 years ago. They found other evidence to show that whales themselves, whether it was whaling or not, but whales themselves had been significant to these cultures for over 5,000 years. So really showing how integral the whales and the whaling tradition was to our people. We pursued mostly humpback and gray whale. They're whales that swim close to the beaches, even though we did hunt finback whale and right whale as well. Whaling held great spiritual significance. In fact, the hunt revolved around spirituality, the prayers, the attention to ritual before the hunt and the preparation. also during the hunt, because in Macaw and Nuchanoth culture, we believe that the whale has this spirit, a spirit that is captured or held in the large dorsal fin of the whale. And if those prayers and songs and ceremonies are done correctly, the spirit brings the physical form of the whale to us. This is very significant to our culture. So there's this reverence that we have for the whale and for the whale's spirit. And so it's treated with utmost respect before the hunt, during the hunt, and after the hunt. So it's ritual-based. There's a lot of rituals that go into the whaling tradition. As for the economic aspects, whale hunts were done during a period of time when the food sources were very low in our communities in the early springtime when we were depleting our food sources. So capturing a whale meant bringing in a lot of food for that community to say, sustain themselves before they started fishing and sea mammal hunting or sealing during the next couple of months in late spring, early summer. So it was very important as well as an economic resource, but also was tied up in those spiritual and social rituals and functions as well.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Charlotte Cote, Associate Professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Washington, and author of the book, Spirits of Our Whaling Ancestors, Revitalizing Macaw and Nuchanoth Traditions. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you briefly go into what led you to no longer hunt whales?
Well, in the mid-1840s, here in Washington State, we started seeing an influx of non-Native people, immigrants moving to the area, being encouraged to move and settle this land because the boundary between Canada or British land and U.S. hadn't been established yet. It hadn't been finalized. So there was this rush to get people in the West Coast and the Pacific Northwest so a presence would be here. So we start seeing this movement here to the West Coast in Washington State, or what was Washington Territory at that time, and also in the colony of British Columbia, which is now the province of British Columbia. So as those people are moving in, they start bringing in these various industries. And here in the Pacific Northwest, a sealing industry began, as well as a fishing industry, but what was the most destructive to the Macaw and Nuchanoth whaling tradition was the commercial whaling industry, which began at this time, really taking form in the 1850s, working from land-based whaling stations, but eventually learning new techniques so that they could go out and process whales right out on their ships. And so that was growing at this period of time. By the 1900s, the commercial whaling industry grew to such levels that when the census were being taken on these whale populations, some of them they couldn't even do census. That's how depleted the whales were. The whales that they focused on were gray and humpback whales because, as I mentioned, those are the whales that swim close to shore. And as a result, as those whales were being depleted, it was harder and harder for the Macaw and Nuchanoth to go out and whale. By the 1900s, even though these whale stocks had been hunted to near extinction by the commercial whaling industry, the Macaw and Nuchanoth, their whole system was tied up in whaling. So it wasn't a matter of, okay, we don't have any whales, we're going to stop whaling. They continued to whale and attempted to whale. But there were other things happening as well. Simultaneously, the U.S. and Canadian governments were initiating policies that effectively weakened and destabilized our entire social system. So with these policies that were undermining our cultures, our languages, our traditions, we also had new subsistence pursuits at this time. We were being brought in partially into the whaling industry, but into the sealing industry, into the fishing industry, into the logging industry. The introduction of this European cash economy really created a shift in emphasis away from whaling. All of this was happening that was starting to impact our communities in so many levels. So if you could go out and wail. And as I mentioned, the people who wail took years and years to prepare. It was something you were raised into, something you knew as a child, that you'd be raised as a wailer. If you now are dependent on a cash economy or are dependent on providing your labor for money, and wailing isn't a part of that, that wailing tradition isn't a part of that, you know that if you're going to wail, it's going to take you away from that. So if you're going out and spending years preparing for wailing, knowing there's a possibility you're not going to get a whale, there's a psychological element to that. Many people started looking at these other pursuits knowing they're going to have to eventually give up that wailing, or at least the wailing would be done a lot less because of those changes to their social systems, the changes to the economies in these communities. So these major economic, social, and spiritual transformations took place. And as a result, it was weakening that connection to that tradition. So you start seeing these major changes in the early 1900s, leading up to the last whale hunts in the 1920s.
And then how did a resumption of whaling come about?
Well, very interesting. Three main factors, and this was with the macaw. In looking at this notion of cultural disruption, and I talk about this in my book, as I'm mentioning, a lot of things are happening at this time, and it's causing the changes, the major changes to happen in these cultures. But rather than focus on that disruption and the breaking down of societies, I focus on cultural continuity. Okay, if all of that was happening, well, why are we still here today? And why are we still talking about a tradition, that aspect of the tradition we hadn't practiced since the late 1920s? Well, that tradition was kept alive in our songs, in our dances, in our ceremonies, in our oral histories. Even though we weren't whaling, we still were raised. I was raised understanding we come from a whaling tradition. And you see it everywhere in our homes, in our communities, through the artistic expression, which if you understand New Chanoth art, which you can see on the front cover of my book, for example, wailing is tied, directly tied to those expressions of art in our communities, with the whale, the thunderbird, and the lightning serpent being very important to the stories that are passed down to us. So the line has been stretched. It has never been broken. That cultural continuity remains. Well, what had happened then? We see various things going on in the macaw communities. And a lot of people don't realize this. In the 1850s, when Governor Stevens in the Washington Territory was signing treaties with the local people here, a treaty was signed with the macaw of Niobe, with the chiefs in Niobe, which became their central reservation, their central village. The macaw insisted if they were going to sign a treaty that whaling had to be included. And they told Governor Stevens, we're not signing this until you guarantee that. So the macaw have in their treaty of 1855 the right to hunt whales. And so that's a treaty protected right. But even though they have that right protected, they, along with the New Chanoth, and Canada is a whaling nation, they, along with the New Chanoth, decided that they weren't going to hunt whales. They could see that the whales were being threatened at that time. By the 1970s, so we're moving up through this period, by the 1970s, when the federal government here in the United States established the Endangered Species Act, the gray whale was one of the first species to be placed on that act because their stocks were still being threatened. At this time, we also see the development of the International Whaling Commission, which is the global whaling body. It oversees whaling throughout the world. So we have these continued restrictions on whaling. At that time, the whale population, at least the gray whale population, that aggregation that goes up from the Baja Peninsula up north to Alaska, that population was 1,500 in the 1970s. By the early 1990s, so we have the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, continually monitoring that whale stock. By the mid-1990s, that whale stock grew to 22,000. The Scientific Committee of the International Whaling Commission looks at that population and they say, that population is healthy and it's growing at a healthy rate. There's no environmental issue with taking some whales out of that population. In fact, it'll help the continued growth. And at that time, in the 1990s, they said you could take up to, I believe, 3 to 450, I can't remember the exact numbers, but a healthy number of whales, and it would still retain that healthy growth. The macaw see this, and they sit down and they start looking at this idea about resuming the whale hunts. Something happened in the 1970s as well, an amazing archaeological discovery within the macaw territory in the abandoned village of Ozette. After a major mudslide, it opened up a village that was approximately 500 years ago. And what they found when they were doing the excavation of that village was over 55,000 artifacts. Many of those artifacts were artifacts linked to their whaling tradition. Harpoons, objects that were used during whale hunts, very, very important, tangible objects that connected them to that tradition and really sparked a growing interest by the elders who were working with the people on the excavation and also the youth, these young people who understood that they came from that tradition but didn't have those tangible items to see that would link them. So it started this revitalization of that understanding of that tradition in this community. Also, what happened in the 1970s was the 1974 Bolt decision, when Judge George Bolt said here in Washington State, treaties are still important. We cannot undermine treaties, and what's written in these treaties must be protected and must be upheld. When the macaw heard that, they said, well, we have that treaty right to whale. So we have these three factors. The macaw move forward in the 1990s and say, we are going to revive that hunt. And so they move forward with preparing for that hunt. May of 1999, they go out and whale and they capture a 30-foot California gray whale, which to them, it becomes a historic event. To all Neuchâtel and macaw, it becomes a historic event because they have brought our tradition full circle.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Charlotte Cote, Associate Professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Washington and author of the book Spirits of Our Whaling Ancestors, Revitalizing Macaw and Neuchâtel Traditions. Let's touch now on some of the objections to resuming whaling from non-native groups and individuals. Would you like to give an overview of those?
So what had happened when the macaw made the announcement in the early 1990s that they were going to revive their hunts? This anti-whaling coalition came together of various groups, some environmental groups and some anti-Indian treaty groups, which many of the people who were a part of those were politicians who continually fought treaty rights and tried to find ways of developing policy that would undermine those rights. So we see this coalition, this very kind of odd coalition developing, because on the one hand, we have environmentalists and animal rights people, and then we have these politicians who are notorious for continually fighting treaty rights and undermining treaty rights, but who, if you look at their political records, are also people who have a bad record when it comes to environmental policies. So we have this very strange alliance of people coming together to fight the macaw whale hunts. Interesting enough, some of the reasoning around whaling was that the U.S. should not allow whaling, for one, because the U.S. supported the macaw. In fact, when the macaw went to the IWC for a whale quota, which it did, even though it has the treaty right to whale, the macaw still wanted to work within the international community and secure a quota from the IWC. The anti-whaling coalition fought that. They tried to stop that. Well, the IWC also provides quotas for other groups here in the United States and did for Canada as well, even though Canada doesn't belong to that whaling body anymore. But the people in northern United States, whale, Alaska Natives whale. And so the macaw were very surprised at this group that came together to oppose their whale hunts. So some of the objections that were being raised at this time were, well, they didn't need to whale. Whales were no longer significant to their cultures. The whaling could harm the whale populations. So as these issues were being raised, the macaw said, well, okay, we've got to look at these issues and we've got to let people know, you know, how we feel about these. And when they were working with the IWC and the scientific body of the IWC, they were disproving a lot of these. In fact, one of the arguments was that it would hurt the whale population. There were studies done by the International Whaling Commission on the whale populations. And I don't know if people remember a while back, and I believe it was in the early 1990s, in the Baja Peninsula, for some reason, whales were beaching themselves. They were beaching themselves on the shores, and not just one or two whales. I think at one point we had 19 whales that had beached themselves in one summer. So people started looking at these, going out there and looking at these whales and trying to find out what was happening to them. Well, what some people were saying was, well, you know, we've got changes in the climate, the ocean climate. That could be a factor. The environment could be a factor. The oceans are getting very dirty. Well, some of these biologists who were working in the Pacific Northwest at the time and working with the international whaling community said, well, there's another factor we got to look at. And this is the fact that this whale population, which was now 26,000, which grew again, continued that increase throughout the 90s, there were so many whales that they reached their carrying capacity. That is, they could not find the food needed to sustain themselves because the whales that were beaching themselves, what they were noticing, they were very low in fat and they were very thin. And so it proved then, at least to us, that if you pull some of those whales out of that population, it's going to allow the rest of the population to grow in a healthy way. So we were trying to explain this, yet the people who were opposing whaling wouldn't believe that. There was also this argument that moving back to whales for subsistence could mean that it could open the door to commercial whaling. And Japan was at that time talking about this possibility of working with people in this area and looking at some kind of commercial venture. The Makah and the Nuchanoth have said from the beginning, even though we did look at that idea, we said we're not looking at it for any commercial venture. We just want to bring back that tradition, revive that aspect of our tradition, and bring it back into our communities. So those were some of the issues that were being raised. Some people said, well, it's not culturally authentic. I mean, this was an argument that was brought forward and which I heard throughout the years because I've done quite a bit of presenting and I've talked quite a bit on this, that I'd have people say, well, it's not part of your culture. Well, what is part of our culture? This is what I would respond. Because you can look at culture in various ways. And the ways that people were looking at our culture was they were seeing culture as something that was fixed and something that was static. Culture isn't fixed. It isn't static. It's dynamic. It changes. And it transitions. It evolves. And so if other cultures can do that, I mean, you think how people who moved here, who immigrated here to this country, do they still live the same way that they lived when they moved here hundreds of years ago? Or did their cultures change? Interesting, when people look at cultures, they don't think of that when they look at other cultures and this change in the culture. For Native people, they always fix us at that time of contact because that's when people started really studying us. And that's when the written record was developed. So they try to keep us stuck in the past. And one of the main arguments about this cultural authenticity of our whale hunts was the use of a firearm during the macaw whale hunt. And the macaw had looked at all of these options. How are we going to revive that hunt? Keeping in sync, really holding on to the qualities of that hunt within that tradition, but also bringing it up into present day because we also are a culture that adapts. And if you can adapt to technologies that are going to make you more successful, you'll do this. I mean, you can see this throughout the archaeological record, our people changing and adapting throughout time. And so the main reason why they decided to use a fire weapon, a gun, was because it would provide a safer hunt for the men and it would also be more humane to the whale. Because sometimes when we hunted in the past, if you hunted and harpooned a whale, it could take a while for that whale to die. So it was the International Whaling Commission And the scientists who asked the macaw to use that gun, they said, we're going to do it because it'll make it a more humane hunt. And people overlooked that. Rather than looking at the fact that we adapted something that made this hunt a more humane hunt, they looked at being as not culturally authentic. So we had those kind of objections being raised as well as we were pursuing the hunt and trying to figure out how we'd move forward with it. But tradition, and I really want people to understand this, culture is dynamic and it changes. We adapt. We've been very successful in adapting. But what I want people to understand, that adapting and adopting of various other cultural forms or practices is done by all cultures as a way to move forward, as a way to make your lives much easier, and also in many respects to be able to live within those societies that have changed as well. You know, our societies aren't still back in the 1800s or the 1700s or 1600s before contact. We understand that we have to move into present day, but to hold on to those aspects of our cultures that still make us unique. And that means keeping alive those traditions that make us who we are as a people. And this is what we were attempting to do as we were revitalizing these hunts.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I really hope that it provides a history that people can read and that it will give them a better understanding of who we are and why we are doing what we're doing, why we want to revive these hunts, why hunting means more to us just than the physical act of going out and whaling, that it's something that is integral to who we are as a people. It is an important element to our identities, and it has spiritual ties, it has emotional ties, physical ties. It's who we are as a people. And I also want people to understand that the writing of this history, it's from the perspective of someone who lived within that culture. And I think that's what I hope to bring to this book, that reading about my story, and I can only say, and I want to make this perfectly clear, I don't speak for the macaw. I don't speak for the Nuchanoth people. What I'm trying to do is provide a history that I heard, also using data that I've collected throughout the last 10 years as I formulated the ideas around this book, but that I was able to work with those and with the perspective of a person raised in that culture and to answer some of those questions that people have about the whaling tradition. And I also want to say, we're not going to please everybody. There will be people who will not agree with whaling no matter what. And people such as the people who are part of the group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. It's an animal rights organization that opposes killing of animals for any reason. And I understand that. We understand that. But we also understand that we're part of the natural world. Predation is also part of life and integral to the world we live in. And so we exist, humans, animals, plants, in this shared environment. And there's that reciprocity within that as well. We look at that relationship with animals, with whales, with the utmost respect, which is why we revere them, which is why we provide prayers and songs and ceremonies to the spirits of these animals and the spirits of the whale. But we also understand that within this symbiotic relationship is the understanding that death is ultimately integrated into life. We understand that. So I want people, as they're reading, to understand that, to see that within the words within this book, and also to understand that whaling is more than just this physical act, that there's a lot more behind that. If you're someone who still ethically cannot understand or you don't believe in hunting or hunting whales, at least you can understand why we do. And I really hope that's what people take away from this book.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you inviting me in today.
You have just been listening to Charlotte Cote, Associate Professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Washington and author of the book Spirits of Our Whaling Ancestors, Revitalizing Macaw and Nuchanoth Traditions, published in 2010 by the University of Washington Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.